The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. At the end of another busy political year.
The experts say the discovery of horse meat masquerading as beef in some Findus lasagnas poses no immediate human health risk.
Today, we launch our welfare reform bill. It brings about the most ambitious, fundamental and radical changes to the welfare system since it began.
We come to this cathedral today to remember before God Margaret Hilda Thatcher.
People are going out and voting UKIP are not just protesting. They're not just sticking two fingers up, although there's very good reason to do so.
An orgy of banker bashing is what we're in for, Russell Brand. Do you think that's what's happening?
I think an orgy of any kind would be great.
The overthrow of Mohamed Morsi is a terrible blow for the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood.
I say fracking! You say no! Fracking! No! Fracking! No!
And how we can possibly be giving £1 billion a month when we're in this sort of debt to Bongo Bongo Land is completely
beyond. On behalf of the General Assembly, I have the honour to welcome to the United Nations the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran and invite him to address the Assembly.
All-night talks, deal-making and political arm-wrestling have failed to stave off government shutdown in the USA.
Senator Silvio Berlusconi's election is declared invalid.
Yes, I have some more to crack for him.
You are in British Gibraltar territorial waters. I consider you to be violating the United Nations Convention.
Our beloved Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, the founding president of our democratic nation, has departed.
With me to discuss it all are The Guardian's very own three wise men, Michael White, Jonathan Friedland and Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, we should get right up to date. Parliament is not on holiday yet, which means that for our noble lords, it's still possible to claim the daily attendance allowance.
Well, I didn't clock in to claim my expenses.
Okay.
I mean, this is all a lot of... It's a storm in a teacup, really. The Rover's got it totally wrong. It's not the way the Lords operate. You have to go in to get the allowances, but most of your work is not in the chamber.
So, Mike, during the great expenses scandal of, I think, 2009, you were much gentler, kinder, we might say, towards the parliamentarians than many others. But listening to Lord Hanningfield there, do you have any sympathy for him?
No, not for Lord Hanningfield. I don't know him personally. He was the Conservative, stressed Conservative on this occasion. Most people have got into trouble have been Labour. Conservative leader of Essex County Council, put up to the House of Lords. And, you know, your jaw drops when you hear a man talking like this. Has he no sense of remorse or shame? He shouldn't have done it. He's on, as it were, on probation, not literally, but people are watching him, and it was an easy mark. And, of course, he's quite right to say he hasn't broken the rules, and I'm sure other people just clock in and take the money. Peers don't get paid, of course. They get expenses. We just have to clock on like a factory. You can clock straight out again. But a man in his position really should know how to behave better than that. I was... a bit depressed by that. It's just wrong, and especially in the middle of a recession, makes all these excesses, like the bankers, doubly wrong.
Martin, this comes in the week after the talk about an 11% increase in salaries for MPs. Do you see that? Is there a connection here? You know, these unpaid lords still doing things that people don't like with expenses?
Well, I think there's a bit of that. I mean, I think, you know, it's any stick to beat a dog with parliamentarians, and in some cases, with good reason, because, I mean, we do have too many parliamentarians at Westminster. We have something like approaching 800 in the House of Lords, which is simply ludicrous and corrupt. But a lot of them do, and a lot of them claim their daily expenses. And we all know, we could all name names of people who, in some cases, wheeled across the line each morning to sign in and then wheeled back out again, literally in their wheelchairs, without making any contribution whatsoever. There are people who do that as a matter of daily course.
I don't know that.
I do.
Okay.
You know, it is a problem. But we have too many parliamentarians, and there is an anti-political mood. And as we have seen right throughout this year, the British press has a vested political interest in denigrating politics, because it doesn't wish to be in any sense accountable or to be proved to whether it tells the truth or not. And so, you know, inevitably we get these things. And of course, you get silly fools who like Hemingfield and several Labour members as well who step over the line.
I had an interesting reminder of all this. I was in the theatre this week and saw The Duck House, which is a classic sort of Whitehall farce, very funny, but it's a good reminder, particularly the audience reaction to it. It's a play about the expenses, and it depicts an MP who's just played every trick in the book. But it was a good reminder seeing the audience reaction of how much revulsion there was at the expenses frauds. The play is littered with references to real life expense cases, you know, so all the examples that are offered are things that were truly claimed for: the duck house, the massage chair, etc. And seeing the audience reaction, it was just a reminder of how deep the skepticism, maybe even cynicism, went after that. That the whole play, the joke of the play, basically relied on a sense that politicians are either idiots or crooks, and the audience more or less lapped that up. And it was a dispiriting reminder of quite how much damage the 2009 affair did.
All the reviewers said it was a rubbishy play, though, didn't they? He never got the money for The Duck House, by the way. It's one of the great myths attaching to MPs' expenses. He didn't get the money. Lots of them didn't. Of course, people behave badly. Don't forget, MPs are representative of the British public, and the British public has got some crooks in it, and so does Parliament.
Mike, it's all winding down now at Westminster, but there was one bit of political serious business to do this week, which is Patrick McLaughlin had to respond to the announcement about Heathrow, which is one of those issues where there's a big split on geographical as well as party lines, isn't it?
Yeah, wicked issues, as somebody once called them, ones which are impossible to resolve. God knows, it's 40 years ago since an airport was proposed for out in the Essex mud flats. Foulness, it was called, and then somebody spotted that's not great marketing, so it became Maplin. Now it's Boris Island, God help us. I've always been a Heathrow man myself, although if they build a new runway, it's going to damage my standard of life, quality of life, because I will live under the northern runway, and I can see the planes where I live, but I don't hear them much, but I'll hear them if it happens. But nonetheless, you look at the London economy and you think, sorry, but this has got to happen. Just make the planes lighter and less fuel consumptive. Organise the air traffic control better so they don't pour kerosene all over Croydon, as Boris Johnson put it in my hearing this week, and make less noisy engines. It's much worse for people living closer to Heathrow than me, but my view is we've got to keep Heathrow and we've got to expand it, and I think that is really what the Davis report is saying, and what the government, having faffed around on this in both directions, Labour's almost as bad. It is as bad. Make your mind up, time, guys.
But they're not going to, are they, Martin? I mean, and particularly it's difficult for David Cameron, who made a bit of a thing about being against it, and Ed Miliband, who was making a big stand against it from within the government, ultimately unsuccessful stand, but was insisting he'd fought the good fight on this one.
I think Mike's exactly right. I mean, it's just one of these questions where there is no absolutely clear-cut right answer. If you were starting this, you wouldn't start from here, but you were where we are. The cost of Boris Island is astronomical, because the infrastructure would be have to be put in place as well, quite apart from any of the technological questions that are involved, and the environmental issues as well. If it were to happen, that would be decades down the line. And it might well be a kind of huge great white elephant. So, I mean, Howard Davis, as Mike said, is really sort of pointing the finger towards Heathrow. But, I mean, I think the pointing towards Gatwick was also quite interesting, because Gatwick is, you know, it could be used much more for some of those long haul flights, and that would that apparently is the air traffic issue, and that would it wouldn't be great for people who live in Crawley, but it would be better for people like Mike.
Johnny, but what about the environment? Have we just forgotten about that now?
It's amazing how quiet that point has been. In this argument, it's been taken as read that we have to do this, and the only question is where. Whereas the Green lobby, and they've not been that vocal. Their argument has always been, well, well, you know, it's a question of whether rather than just where do we need it. Firstly, there's this issue of that having a hub airport. You know, these are planes that come in and then go out again. How much benefit do they really give to the British economy? These are people who often don't leave the airport. How much, you know, benefit is there for us in that if this hub traffic goes somewhere else?
2 hours of shopping.
Well, you know, I mean, exactly. The retail opportunities of Heathrow are not enough, frankly, to justify this kind of environmental consequence. But there's also this view that actually, there is a sort of suspension of the rules, normal rules of the market of supply and demand, because aviation is kept cheap. Cheaper in a way than its environmental damage should suggest. And if each long-haul flight or even short-haul flight cost as much for the passenger as it really costs, then fewer people would travel and there'd be a decrease in aviation.
This is the argument
that Christian Wollmar, who's thinking of running as an independent for Mayor of London, transport expert, former journalist, this is the argument he makes, that until now it's this predict and provide model. You predict how much travel there'll be and provide ever more runways to cope with it. And he says maybe we should manage down demand. The problem is a political one, which is people want cheap holidays and cheap travel, and people feel entitled to almost as a right, and therefore the politicians do have to provide the space. But it has been striking how quiet the weather argument has been, whether or not it's been mainly been about where.
When Mike Cameron and Miliband were against this in 2008-09, that was the absolute disaster hitting the economy in the, you know, that was the real trough.
Yeah, but the trough was we thought we were a quick dip in and out with the recession, and the worse and the longer it gets, this dreadful flatlining stagnation prospect which we face with a very little or no growth and not enough proper jobs, they're going to become more desperate. And when Boris says you can fly five times to China from Helsinki nowadays, that's three or four more times than you can from Heathrow, makes a potent argument along with the stuff that Johnny mentions. Point to point, flying in lighter, more fuel-efficient aircraft is a real case against hubs. Maybe hubs are last year's model. However, I must say, since we were talking about MPs' expenses, I think this is a far bigger condemnation of the political elite than a few people fiddling their expenses and other people treating them as allowances, not expenses, which was what, of course, they were encouraged to do, though you wouldn't have read that in the Daily Telegraph. The failure to do strategic transport thinking and infrastructure thinking of a wider kind, particularly energy, we're in a very bad place at the moment with the closing of our power stations. This is the real condemnation. Political class lack courage.
Well, let's take a slightly longer view now, instead of looking back on the week, and just look back on the year, because it is that stage of the game in late December. Mike, the polls have been reasonably steady. Boris, who was all over everywhere in 2012, has retreated a bit into the background. America didn't default. The euro didn't implode. And all the party leaders look remarkably safe. Has it been a boring year in politics?
Yes and no. You want politics to be boring, frankly. You know, the Third Reich was really lively all the time. Chairman Mao's Cultural Revolution, that was never dull either. So be grateful for politicians who are only mildly villainous and only taking a few bob from the petty cash. I'm being serious here, and not for the interesting ones. Beware of the man with a white horse. Yeah, they're not very impressive, our political leaders. An old Labour hand said to me about a fortnight ago, shaking his head, it's old men's talk, I know. He says, it's the first time in my adult life when none of the three major parties has been led by somebody who fit to be prime minister. Now, old man's talk, but a sobering moment. The recovery of the economy is a good thing. We all want the economy to do well, and we want the government to get all the credit it deserves, but it's a pretty thin recovery, you know, and it's fueled a great deal of it on credit and on low wages and on hacking back benefits, which hurt some of the most vulnerable people in our society, and the burgeoning sense of injustice and inequality. We've been very docile about it, apart from the London riots, which were really opportunist, not political. But you know, you do wonder. I'm talking to you today from King's Lynn in Norfolk, out for a family event, and it looks bright and prosperous in the sunshine, and the town centre looks good. It hasn't got a lot of competition for 40 or 50 miles. But it's a different world from the London and the South East, particularly London and Central London. It troubles me a great deal.
Martin, I mean, all the figures now say that the economy is going to continue to pick up. Mike's saying in large parts of the country, though, it still doesn't feel like it. Do you think 2014 will be different? Do you think we'll finally feel the recovery? And then as a result, do you think that will transform the political game?
I think the same answer as Mike gave to a different question, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think you can already see that the party battle is gradually beginning to wear the effect of the beginnings of the recovery. You know, taking all the points which Mike made about its fragility and its and inequality. I mean, if you actually, it feels as though nothing's happening in the polls. But if you actually look at where the polls are right now this week, compared with where they were 1 year ago, the Labour lead in YouGov this morning is 4, and the Labour lead in YouGov 1 year ago was 11. Now, these figures move around, of course.
Down 3 or 4,
but, isn't it? It is down a bit, and I think it's down a bit partly because there is a little bit more money around in some parts of the country, and in some with some parts of the electorate, and people are feeling a little bit more confident in a kind of conditional way. Is it going to have a big impact in 2014? Well, the no bit is, I think, precisely because I think we're into a longer term coping with the fact that the European model is under pressure from globalization, that all countries in Northern Europe, and not just in Northern Europe, but certainly all countries in Northern Europe, are facing the problem of not quite having enough money to pay for the benefits of an aging population and low birth rates and so on. We see this particularly in Germany, but it's also true in many other parts of Europe. But it's not just a demographic problem, it's also a political problem. And so I'm pretty conditional about my confidence about the recovery. It is going to still be pretty fragile. You know, wages, real wages, will still be significantly down in 2015 at the time of the next general election compared with what they were in 2010 at the time of the last one.
It's funny, isn't it, Johnny? Because right throughout this parliamentary term, like whenever pollsters ask voters, you know, what matters to you and your family, what's the biggest challenge facing the country, absolutely consistent, it's the economy or some version of the economy. Yet the economy has moved substantially in terms of the headlines this year, which were dreadful 12 months ago. And then, as Martin says, you've had, if anything, in the polls, quite a small movement. Do you think people are just too polarised now?
There is this disconnect, isn't there, between these headline figures, the ones that people say at the end of the news bulletin, you know, about whether it's the stock market or inflation rates, etc., and how the economy feels, how it is to, you know, lived. And, you know, it's like the old Groucho Marx thing. What are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? You know, so you can hear David Cameron at PMQs trumpet these series of statistics where the good figures are going up and the bad figures are going down. And for some people, that may, for those people who are in work and whose mortgages are either low because of interest rates or paid off, maybe those figures influence them to feel better and more confident. The question for that, in a way, on which Labour's fate hangs, is how many more people are there who can hear all those figures, but for whom those figures mean nothing because their own daily lives are hard and continue to be hard, and therefore they want something different. And that's the bet Labour's making by talking about the cost of living all the time. They're saying this is a recovery on paper, Mr. Cameron, but the voters out there don't feel it. And they need tens of millions of people to feel that way in order to have any kind of electoral hope. The worry for them, though, is that there's a body of people in between who will see those figures and hear those figures and think, OK, the government's been right. Osborne's been vindicated. We've turned the corner. And I think that's what probably accounts for those few percentage drops in the poll lead.
I mean, I do wonder, though, if there's some, like Mike was talking about, the sort of people being fed up and seeing some people getting better off, some regions maybe getting better off, that people are so dug into trenches now that they're going to kind of see in this recovery whatever they want to see. The people who kind of thought that they wanted plan A to work will say it's worked, and the people who didn't are going to say, well, whose recovery is it anyway?
Yeah, I mean, the argument, the sort of original austerity argument is over in a way. The sort of, and this is partly why Ed Balls has struggled, because he was sort of saying that, you know, the economy is going to. He made a bet that the economy would contract, and you saw David Cameron taunting Ed Miliband over this, saying, "You said there were going to be a million fewer jobs, and actually there's a million more jobs." It's too hard to get into that, even though Ed Balls would say, "Look, I was right. I said austerity would slow down the recovery, and sure enough, it's taken 3 years much longer than it should have taken." But it's very hard to go back into that argument now. Instead, it has to be on: does this feel to you like a recovery, and is it a recovery for the few? And that's where they've shifted. And as I say, the question of whether that is enough to deliver in a kind of electoral gain or advantage majority for Labour depends completely on how many people feel that's true and describe their own experience.
And Mike, it feels like Labour's kind of running a much more left-wing strategy, if you like, or a left-facing strategy, trying to mop up Liberal Democrat votes from last time rather than Conservatives, maybe, with the tax on some of these big businesses, on the energy companies and so on. And do you think that's right? Do you think they're picking up on that point about injustice, or the perception
of
injustice?
Cost of living injustice, social injustice. And that's where Ed Miliband's instincts lie in many ways, left populism. And one of the sort of minor rows of the year was, of course, when the Daily Mail went after his father. Ralph Miliband is a man who hates Britain. It was a shocking headline. But there's something there, the feeling that somehow Ed is his father's son more than David is. David is more centrist, more Blairite, if I can still use that word. And Ed's instincts lie this way. Now, he's had some successes on the energy prices. He's put the government on the back foot and various other things. And that doesn't mean he'll reap an electoral reward from it if Labour isn't trusted on the economy. And that means him and Ed Balls, and I'm afraid they were at the scene of the crime when voters blame Gordon Brown for spending too much money and taking the eye off the regulating of those wicked, lazy, greedy banks in 2007-08, the run-up to that. So I don't think he'll benefit from this, and people are kind of, they like their cake and eat it. They like bashing the energy companies and bashing the banks and all those targets. But if the government is responsive, and it is being responsive, even at the price of a few U-turns, and says, yes, we're addressing these concerns, then you're in danger of being left as the Lib Dems were for so many years. All their good policies get nicked, and all the daft ones are left as a sort of mess on the bottom of the pint pot, and people say, look at their Lib Dem policies, they're all daft. Actually, they have good ones too. And Labour's in that risk area. I'm still not convinced Ed Miliband's going to emerge the leader of the largest party after 2015, despite the crossness with the government, because as Martin said earlier, people are pretty hacked off with the pretty political class and look for easy ways of excusing themselves and blaming other people, like we all do.
An awful lot of this, Martin, we could have had a similar discussion really a year ago, despite the fact there wasn't a recovery then. One novel thing that happened in politics this year is that the government was defeated in the Commons on the question about whether to go to war or get involved in military action, whatever the phrase was. I couldn't remember anything like that happening, and then people popped up to say it hadn't happened for 200 years.
Well, it was an unusual event, and it was partly an unusual event because of the configuration of a hung parliament, which we've got, which meant it was difficult to construct a majority across the House. I mean, I think it was where public opinion was, and it did politics in general, I think, quite some short-term credit. But of course, now we're looking at the state of the refugee crisis, the hunger crisis, and the continuing slaughter in Syria, and the prospect possibly that things are going quite well for the Assad regime. So, you know, what goes around comes around, and that, you know, so those issues haven't gone off the boil, and we may get a mild form of buyer's remorse at some point down the line. Though I think basically the effect of Iraq is still very strong, and people just don't want Britain to get involved in these wars, and the military are talking about the consequences of that only this week. So, I mean, I think that was quite a significant event for some people, but I don't think it's going to be a very lasting...
Johnny, I mean, the thing that I was interested in more is at this time where, you know, at the beginning we've had Mike say that, you know, there are old hands saying that none of the politicians are any good anymore, the public don't like them because of expenses. And yet, through it all, this thing that The Guardian's probably called for a long time, Parliament, as opposed to the government, being a bit more assertive. Is there some funny sense in which Parliament's doing more useful and more assertive things than it used to?
Yeah, certainly, and that's and the Syria example illustrates it very well. And that's but I wouldn't overflatter Parliament. What I would say is it's because it was a hung Parliament. This is a debate Mike and I have had over, going back over the years. But my sense of Parliament is that when there's a full and particularly a landslide majority, it is in effect just a sort of standing electoral college, just to keep the executive installed and is and doesn't have day to day muscle. But the minute it's a hung Parliament, absolutely, the action moves to Westminster and to the Commons, and that is completely what's happened. So that you've had, you know, this record number of rebellions on the government side, you've had these interesting cross-party sort of constellations, as you did have on Syria, where you had a large rebel faction on the Tory side, and so suddenly every vote counts, and you know, as we're talking about the year in politics, a big, you know, cultural expression was outside Parliament. It was across the river at the National Theatre, this play, This House, which suddenly took a whole lot of people over to see the fate of the Labour government in the 1970s, where every vote absolutely counted, and it was a matter of, you know, talking about wheeling in parliamentarians, that happened. And it was interesting how many MPs from Now went across to see that play and saw something reflected back at them. There are these moments, perhaps it's once a generation, or maybe it's going to happen much more now, where Parliament truly matters, but the rest, it's not always the case.
Well, I don't buy that. The Labour government of 74-9 in that brilliant play Johnny mentioned did survive all 5 years despite the revolts. Blair and Thatcher, with enormous majorities, had revolts against them. They didn't matter as much because you need more votes to win. So that's the difference. But MPs have been revolting on a much more formidable and regular and exponential scale for the last 25 years. They reflect the discontent of the public with government. It's just that the numbers make a difference. So to that extent, of course, the coalition's more vulnerable. But Blair had record numbers of revolts against him too, you know.
But the point is, it didn't matter. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Before we close for the year, I think it's only fair to give, because I've doubtless forgotten lots of important things, to give everybody a chance to say what they think the new year is going to hold in the light of the 12 months that we've just had. So first of all then, Martin.
Well, I'll be watching the European elections in May, because everyone, I think, is expecting UKIP to do very well in those elections, and that will have an influence on the way we get into the run-up through to the general election in 2015. There's a significant part of the Tory party which continues to mourn the departure of Mrs. Thatcher, who, of course, whose death this year we ought to at least flag up in this review of the year. And they are very influential. They've, as we were talking about just before, you know, in a hung parliament, the right of the Tory party has been quite influential, and they've been able to set the agenda, and they're very worried about UKIP, and so, and immigration is all a grist to that mill. So all of those things, I think, are where a lot of the action is going to be in politics in 2014.
And Johnny, what would you take out of this year and into the next?
Well, one date circled on the calendar, not just for me, but anybody who follows politics, is September the 17th, or September the 18th. One date circled on the calendar for me and everybody who follows politics is September the 18th, 2014. It's the referendum on independence for Scotland, which will just be, you know, the campaign itself is already in full throat, and it will just only get louder and bigger as the year goes on. Mostly people are thinking that the polls are saying that the no side is very strong. My feeling is this is going to really tighten, and that yes have a lot of very, very big cards to play. Alex Salmond, I've said before, I think is probably the most effective politician on these islands. And he has a big emotional case to make, which the no side is really struggling to articulate. And if it did happen, it would in some ways be the final act of the Margaret Thatcher period, which of course did close in 2013. You know, it was the Thatcher government and the Thatcher era, which did seem to alienate much of Scottish politics from the rest of the UK, and particularly from England, in a kind of permanent way, so that there can never be a Conservative. There has just never been a Conservative strong presence in Scotland ever since Margaret Thatcher. And if Scotland was to break away, it would be in some ways the very final act of that process.
And Mike, the year has been dominated by one story as far as The Guardian's concerned, which is the revelation about ubiquitous spying or so-called metadata from the NSA and related programmes in the US and in Britain. Do you think that's going to have ramifications into next year as well?
Well, it's one of those things which doesn't get people going in the Dog and Partridge unless you persuade them all that The Guardian is a treasonable organisation which has put everybody's lives at risk, which has certainly been an attempted version of events from within Whitehall, not particularly successful. And I've always had confidence in this Guardian story. I don't say that every day, but it always seemed we'd win this one in the end. And even the last 24 hours or so, the White House's own review panel has said the National Security Agency, and therefore by extension GCHQ, has got too much power, and it ought to be diminished, to quote an old phrase. And it's typical, I'm afraid, of the British establishment reaction, which is sort of slow and complacent, but will end up following the Americans, as we do far too often. There's a balance to be struck between liberty and security, as there is in all these issues we've been talking about. Scotland between independence, autonomy, and living in the real world, Britain and Europe between getting silliness from Brussels off our back, but at the same time remaining a member of Europe, letting immigrants in, but not too many of them. Balance. You can tell I'm a Libran, Tom. I was born at the end of October, and on the NSA, we're going to get the balance better, and The Guardian's going to win this one in 2014, and well done the team. It wasn't down to me, but we got it right.
Moderation in all things except patting ourselves on the back. That's all we've got time for this week, and also indeed for this year. Hope that all of you listening have a good break, and we'll be back in January. Producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks very much indeed for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.